This week's parashat is parashat Bishalach. Bishalach is when the Jews finally do leave. Now, there are many, many details in Bishalach. To understand the parasha properly, you really need to chart them, to see where we start, to see where we end, to see all the pieces in the middle. And it's one where there is finally some movement. And when I say movement, I'm talking about geographical movement. We start here, we end up here, we go here along the way. And the geographic movement is itself interesting because, you know, since the start of the book, we've really been in one place, and now we finally leave. Now, everything I just now said that we should do, we're not going to do today. But that's really what one needs to do. The second thing that you need to do is to notice the various intrigue which takes place from place to place, the various problems that come up, and the solutions which are suggested, and then to try to understand what kind of process this is taking place. And I think that any of us who think in terms of education could think about the challenge of educating an entire generation of people who are now have had their lives changed dramatically because yesterday they were slaves and now they're free, and now the challenges which are going to present or be presented to them are completely different challenges than they've ever experienced. So that's also something which we need to do. Just in terms of irony, we start the parsha by saying, "Vayhi b'shalach paro ta'am," right? When Paro sends them, and we can read in parenthetically, finally sends them. "V'lo nacham elokim derech eretz plishtim ki karofu." They don't go derech eretz plishtim because it's close. So that itself, immediate frustration, because there was a shorter way to go. There was a quicker way to get there. "Ki amar elokim," for God said, because perhaps when they see battle, when they see war, they're going to be frightened and they're going to return back to Egypt. Which right away tells you something which is very sad, and that is that God senses, and it's very difficult to use the word sense with God. God knows that they're not ready. They're not ready. You know, and for all those sources, Hashem chishev et haketz, and he took us out early, but now's the downside of coming out early, that we're just not ready to be out yet. We're not really ready to be free yet. We're really not ready to face the challenges. Which means, as much as we end up thinking afterwards, we end up spending 40 years in the desert because we did this and did this and did this, the real reason we spend 40 years in the desert, and I'll just take out the word 40, the real reason we don't go immediately to the land of Israel is because we're just not ready to go yet. How do we know what ready to go? Well, look at all the things that happen in the desert. But I'm saying that's not circular logic. Right over here, we're being told they're not ready to face war. So what's... Yeah?
It's sad that Kikarofu, that their memory is so short, that how they suffered as slaves for all these years, for 210 years, and they... And after 2 seconds, they forgot what it was like, and war is even worse, and let's go back to Egypt, even though it was bad.
And we know we're going to hear that speech time after time in the desert, but over here, God is already telling us a secret. Yeah, this is part of the problem. Now, what I said in the beginning, there's irony. What's the irony? By the time we get to the very end of the parasha, we get to war. We do face war. We do face battle. They end up being engaged in war. So therefore, even though God took us, you know, the longer way, it still really didn't help. So again, there's different types of battles, different types of wars, or different types of situations. The way that was avoided, this is what's important, the way that was avoided would have been to travel the logical way, and that means to come up the coast. Never cut through the desert, just come up the coast. The shortest way would have come up the coast. You would have had water resources the whole time. You would have arguably had fish the whole time and other things the whole time. Just come up the coast would have been the shortest way. Derech Eretz Plishtim, just imagine, to come to Israel, come up via Gaza, and you'd be in Israel fairly quickly instead of going through the desert. Just think logically for a second. Well, which makes a little more sense? Should we go through the desert? But it seems to be right away, God is taking them the longer way around, because they're not ready to fight for the land of Israel. They're not ready for this kind of battle. And you can start to argue that perhaps the battle that took place with Amalek is very different from this kind of battle, but still I'm going to say that there is irony the way that we start the parsha, the way we end the parsha, and that means maybe we didn't accomplish all that we could have or should have accomplished. And the other thing about going backwards, again, not just geographically, but going backwards, is the various complaints that come up. We constantly have complaints coming up in this parasha. These are very hard people to work for. And some of the things are predictable and some of the things are frustrating. The constant complaints about water, the complaints about food, which we understand. But, you know, in a certain sense, it almost reminds us of the Soviet Union. Soviet society was not a wonderful society, but they did take care of all the basic needs. Mother Russia, right? Mother Russia really did take care of all of the basic needs, and therefore the basic needs included having a job, having a place to live, heat, right? Heat. What? Again, excuse me. I said basic needs. No. They did have the basic needs. The problem is that's all they had. Generally, was the basic needs. But when the Americans would protest against the Soviets and say that, what about human rights violations? Right, you are not allowing certain things. And in America, the most basic human rights was freedom of movement. That you can go from one place to the other. You want to get on a plane, you get a passport, you get on a plane. You want to travel. And I'm saying the most basic rights in terms of freedom of movement. And they didn't have this kind of rights, along with almost all the other rights you can imagine. But their response was, why are there so many homeless people in America? That was a moral response. Why are there so many homeless people in America? What happened to the most basic human rights? Most basic human rights, a person has the right to a place to live. I'm not telling you this was a wonderful life, but what I am pointing out is that those who left and then ended up having freedom were sometimes very, very surprised to find out that certain things that just came for free no longer come for free. There's a price to be paid for freedom, and the price paid for freedom is you don't get a free house, you don't get a job, and you don't get heat. Again, we were in Moscow in the winter. It's very, very cold there. And it was essentially it was free that everybody had a place to live and everybody had heat in their homes. So that was something.
I'm sorry, I'm starting with the first two pages. Everybody take two pages and
B'li neder b'zrat Hashem. Okay. So let's now that you have some sources, let's now begin. So Paro sends them off, and then lo and behold, we read in source number one, for those of you who have it, yes, we read in source number one, Vayugad l'melech Mitzrayim ki varach ha'am. He was told that the people had escaped. V'yafech levav Paro v'avadav el ha'am. That they suddenly have a second thought about what they had done. And part of the problem all the way through had always been, we discussed this a bit, was the tension of the Jews always asking for 3 days and never had asked for more than that. But when we finally got to the point of midnight and Paro's running around and it's his go, and you're free. At that point, apparently, Paro just wanted nothing more to do with these people anymore. They didn't need them anymore. They were destroying Egypt, as we had seen last time. And now, it suddenly dawns on them that maybe we've made this terrible mistake. And again, Vayugad l'melech Mitzrayim ki varach ha'am, v'yafech levav Paro v'avadav el ha'am, v'yomu ma zot asinu. What did we do? Ki shilach niso me avdenu. Then, and now we no longer have our servants. So he takes off his chariots and his people. And this is the real power of the Egyptian army. So as much as we thought that all this was over and we're out of Egypt and we're just waiting for our next thing and we're not ready for fighting, we're not ready for battle, but lo and behold, here is another battle which is about to take place, or perhaps will be averted. I don't want to ruin the story for you. But now you have the Egyptians are chasing after them, and that obviously is going to be something which is quite disturbing. So now, full stop. And we're going to do now something which is a little strange today. I'm not going to apologize. This is my prerogative. your prerogative is not to come, but this is my prerogative, something which is strange. Now, the big advantage that you have is I've thrown out a couple of things along the year that you're actually going to understand a lot of what we're going to do. This is a lot you won't understand, which is also okay. But what we're going to start right now is a passage in the Zohar, and we'll read it a bit. And the reason we're reading the passage in the Zohar is not because of the passage in the Zohar, but rather because of the Vilna Gaon's commentary of the Zohar, which in a sense is breathtaking, and it also in a sense is completely incomprehensible. But it'll make sense, but then we're going to use that to go a little bit further. And really, the whole class today is really based upon some teachings of the Vilna Gaon, which some of them I'm going to say again that you know. Those of you who don't know, the Vilna Gaon is seen, at least among Ashkenazim, as being the greatest rabbinical authority probably the last 400 or 500 years. During his lifetime, he was seen as being the greatest rabbi in the world. People regularly looked at him as if he were a throwback to the time of Rashi or the Rambam or the Ritva, where they had no problem with him arguing with much, much early authorities. The Vilna Gaon, to a very large extent, was Judaism's Mozart, where the legends about him as a child and what he knew as a child genius, were absolutely... And it's hard sometimes to really separate between legend, exaggeration, versus real history. I've seen various historians try to do this, and perhaps the best way that they can do it is by only using sources of people telling stories of people who actually met him, rather than stories that are told second or third generation, but only using those first-hand stories, there is something which is very really difficult for us to understand. But there is something very specific that I want to get to in terms of talking about him. The Vilna Gaon was, first of all, a mathematical genius. As far as we know, he had mastered every single area of human knowledge other than pharmacology, because his father told him if he were really a doctor, then he would have to spend time saving lives, and then he would not be able to only sit and learn. This is something which is said by his children. The other thing which I'm not convinced he really was interested in was Greek philosophy and other ancient philosophy, which he felt was just completely wrong and completely missed the mark. And he has some really harsh things to say about those, including the Rambam, who spent some time with it. Now, as a very, very young man, apparently he mastered all Jewish knowledge. He had the kind of mind where he simply knew everything that you could imagine in terms of Jewish literature. He had it all in his mind, but not just that, he understood it in a deeper way than we can possibly imagine. And the way that I would give an example of this would be that if I were to say, Poteach et yadecha, do all of you know the next word? Yes, you know, okay, Ashrei, no. What's the word before Poteach? So now you have to think a little bit, to go backwards. The Vilna Gaon knew it forwards and backwards. Which is, you can ask him at any point, what's the word before? And he also knew the miracle value of things immediately. He knew every single Gemara which came and followed this. Rav Chaim Volozhin once came to speak with him. And Rav Chaim Volozhin is considered to be one of his students. And he said that I've mastered the Gemara of Sukkah. So he says to him, okay, how many times does Abaye and Rava argue? How many times does Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua argue? And he's just like, look. So then he starts giving him, telling him every single argument in it, and giving gematrias based upon the Chumash. Oh, this is according to the times that it says Sukkah spelled with a vav. They argue according to the times that it says Sukkah without a vav. And it just starts going into all kinds of things, and just people sitting there just could not possibly fathom the kind of knowledge. Now, that's one whole level of it. The other level of it is that he also, and this is sometimes we don't know about this, because in a certain sense, the Vilna Gaon fathered what we would call today the yeshiva world. This Rav Chaim Volozhin then opens up the yeshiva Volozhin. The yeshiva Volozhin then ends up impacting all the other great yeshivas which follow afterwards. But the Vilna Gaon was also the greatest master of Kabbalah during his life as well. A matter of fact, I heard this, I cannot back this up, but I heard, I was at a conference in the university a couple of years ago on the Vilna Gaon, and somebody there who should have known said that the Vilna Gaon had more writings on Kabbalah than all the Hasidim combined. which is just an unbelievable statement. But that was how many writings. Now, the other thing about his writings is he never wrote anything after the age of 40. And he died at the age of 70. And he never taught. He never was Rosh Yeshiva. Very few people actually were in direct contact with him other than family. And he wasn't the kind of person who normally gave shir. He didn't have a yeshiva. He sat by himself and he learned. Rav Chaim Volozhin was considered to be this great student. Rav Chaim Volozhin, I don't know how many times he met him in his life. When he was 27 years old and the entire Jewish world was involved in an argument between Rav Yonasan Eifshitz and Rav Yaakov Emdin, everybody was taking sides, they asked the 27-year-old Vilna Gaon to adjudicate. And he very wisely sidestepped it, which shows that he was also clever, which is sometimes not taken for granted. Enough about all this. I told you the reason why we're here is because we want to read a passage from the Zohar and then see the Vilna Gaon's comment to the Zohar. And it's going to leave you a lot of food for thought. And if this goes well, then you will, over the next couple of weeks, if you think about it, you'll tell me a lot more than he tells us. But let's just start. The Tikkun HaZohar, I see now, is unnumbered. It's after source number one. The Ilana de Eitz Hadat. Okay, we all know what that means. The tree which was the Eitz Hadat, Tov Ra. Tzorech Lemevad Ba Perud Ben Tov L'Ra. What is the spiritual work that needs to be done when we deal with the Eitz Hadat Tov Ra? Lemevad, this work. Now keep in mind work, because work will be very important to this whole discussion. We need to do work, and what's the work? To separate between Tov and Ra. Why? What's the problem of eating from the Eitz Tov Ra? The problem is you end up with a combination, an erbuvia. You end up with a combination and therefore a confusion between Tov and Ra. So therefore the work of dealing with the Eitz Tov Ra is to create a separation between Tov and Ra. Hadhu dichtiv, that's what it says, Vayavdel Elokim bin Or uben Choshech. And Or uben Choshech is therefore between Tov v'Ra. V'tzorech l'me'evad, now notice that word again, you need to work. L'me'evad kitzutz bin l'mahavi barnash b'lo yetzahara. And one needs to work in order to create the separation, in order to take away from a person, barnash as a human being, from having a yetzahara. Kigavne dekatzitz le'minei v'hargei, Bigar sate, haduhu dichtiv, libi chalol bikirbi. I'll translate when I want to. Ulakabel mem tet mi metatron. Inu mem tet panim tahar. There's an angel called Metatron. Metatron is the angel who is called the Sar Hapnim, which has a different connotation, certainly today. But Metatron is the spiritual, angelic form of Yosef, because Yosef is really basically the Baal HaBayit down here, who's the second in command in terms of Paro. Metatron is the angel who has all kinds of control. But Metatron, it says, Inun represents Memtet, which represents Memtet Panim Tahor, the 49 levels or aspects of things which are pure. Umisitra disama'el, and on the negative side, memtet panim tame. Now this is going to be a very important concept that I want you to carry all the way through today, and that is there is a great deal of spiritual power in this universe. Unfortunately, often when there is going to be something which is good and wholesome and holy, there will also be a possibility of what we can call a klipa, of something which is counterfeit, and something which is tame, and something which is negative. So the reality is there's actually 50 Sharei Bina. So what's the 50th? The 50th is already God-given understanding and God knowledge, which is, on the 50th level, there's only good. But on the 49 lower levels, there's going to be both good and bad, because that's the point. Which means, when it comes down to it, right, there's one God. There's only one God. There's no negative. There's no klipa. There's no sitra achra of that. But anything under than God itself, in terms of all kinds of spiritual things, here you see right here that there's metatron, that there's therefore eitz tov v'ra, or v'choshech, light and dark, good and evil, and so on. Memtet, now we have a number to it, the 49 levels, which all of you understand that the 49 levels also have to do with leaving Egypt, good. Umisitrusama memtet panim tame. Umanda zochi lechabra hei lememtet panim de tahor. And anybody who somehow succeeded in attaching hey, this is the letter hey, to the 49, the ihu, where did that 5 come from? Chamisha chumshe Torah. That if you're able to take the power of Torah, which is the hey, from Chamisha chumshe Torah, hay, the five books of Torah, you're able to put the hay together with the mem tet, what do you end up with? It ovid, by the way, notice again, you've worked, you've done something. What have you made? You've created a mate. Okay? Now, limacha'a be li yitzre, ba'a yud di'ihu eser micha'in, and further, in order to fight against the Yetzer Hara, you have a yud, just as the letter yud again, which creates the 10 makot. V'hainu hey yud min Elokim, and this hey and this yud, when you put them together, this is the hey and the yud from Elokim. Uveginda it's kremata ha'Elokim, and that's why it's considered to be the staff of God, which is of course what Moshe takes in his hand. Uval hay mateh ihu vav. There's also a vav. This is the vav hachibor, the vav which connects. The itmar bay hinei nochi karet brit neged kol amecha. To karet ime yud gim amichlin derachme delo yachzare kam bitziluta. And this is the vav hachibor which connects us with God, which is when you pray and you say the yud gim omidot, then you will not go away empty handed when you pray. Again, I'm going to read that line. To karet ime yud gim amichlin derachme delo yachzare kam bitzilute, that you're not going to go empty handed after you pray. De elim. What does elim mean? Elim? Or elaim, if you like, if you prefer. What's elaim?
Mute,
where you can't pray, the inability to pray, there are no words. Elim below hey itu rekam vidahu dem amar Yaakov lule elokei avi elokei Avraham ufachet Yitzchak hayili ki ata rekam shalachtani. And that's why Yaakov prayed, had it not been for this connection with my father, grandfather, I would have gone empty-handed. But my begin to itmar belovin v'techlev smiskoratai aseret monim. And why does it say, and lovin had changed, and why does it say this? Because lovin had changed his wages 10 times. Uvat yud, and therefore the yud comes in, it avid leid nes, and the yud comes in and makes this miracle, delokim afik mine hey, and the hey comes in, nishar ilaim, rak below arayta baal peh, without the Torah Shabbat peh, because you need to connect it again with the Chamisha Chum Shtar, and now you see the Torah Shabbat peh avoman. Tetzali tziluta li'ilona dechai, someone who prays to the Eitz HaChayim, which is Torah, lo yachzor rekam bitziluta ololam, will never go empty-handed. V'ginda it Elokim misitra de Eitz HaDat Tovara. On the other hand, when we approach God from the perspective of the tree of knowledge and good and evil, where you have this combination and confusion, v'it Elokim chayim v'melech olam misitra d'ilan d'chaye. And on the other hand, there's this aspect of God revealed from the Eitz HaChayim. V'lo zachin lo elamori kabbalot yodin rozin d'irayt. And the only ones who really understand all this are those who understand Kabbalistic things. So now, do I care that none of you understood anything I just now said? No, not at all. But I did want you to see the source to at least get a sense. Yeah, we all understand this in the vaguest possible terms, correct? We know there was something about Eitz HaDaat Tov HaRa. We know there's something about 49 levels. We know there's something about the use of the name of God and the appearance of the Yud and the Hay. We know something about the Mateh over here. We know that there was this fear that Yaakov could have gone empty-handed, and it's the prayer which allows us our prayer. It's our authentic prayers to God, which allows us not to go empty-handed. So it was in the most general, like really the broadest strokes, we understand a little bit of this, correct? And as I said, the reason we're here is not for the source, but to see the Vilna Gaon's comment on the source. I just didn't want his comment to be completely, completely separated from everything. So now we'll read source number 2. Rekam shalachtani, I would have gone empty-handed. Right, Yaakov would have gone empty-handed had he not known how to pray. Shehu vav malay. So what he's pointing at is that the vav is malay. Which vav is malay? The vav in Elokim. Elo. But there's no vav there. But the vav is malay. Why is the vav malay? Because we pronounce it Elokim, right? So therefore, that's the vav that he's referring to. Kanal below yud ke. Elaim. Because if you take away the vav, and you take away the yud and the hey, then what are you left with? Elaim. Again, that you can't say anything. V'ha'inyan, and what's the issue? So now the Vilna Gaon is about to tell us what's really going on. V'inyan ki Yaakov v'Lavan dugmat Yisrael b'Mitzrayim, that the prototype of Yaakov leaving the house of Lavan is manifested in the leaving of Yisrael b'Mitzrayim. Kimosha Amru Ha'avot Heim Siman Levanim Galut Yaakov. Just like people say, Ma'aseh Avot Siman Levanim. So that's something we're familiar with, that history tends to repeat itself. But this comparison right now, Yaakov leaving Lavan and Am Yisrael leaving Mitzrayim, is something which perhaps we've never thought of, and the reason we haven't thought of it, because they're very, very different. The Achar Kach, Lakach, it's Kol Rechusho. And what happens when Yaakov leaves? He takes all of Lavan's possessions. Kimosha Katuv, Hine Re'iti Et Kol Asher Lavan. V'chein, and similarly, V'yinatzlu Et Mitzrayim, that the Jews, they took advantage or they emptied out Egypt. So far, what is he saying? That there is a comparison between Yaakov leaving Lavan together with Am Yisrael leaving Mitzrayim. And so far, what is the comparison? So far, it's only based on one thing. And what's that one thing? The possessions. Going away with the possessions. Uvimakel laka Lavan biruchusho. And Lavan was punished, or this was worked with the makel. Yes? Is that true? Is there makel in that story?
Yeah,
with the makel. Uv biruchusho dugmat mate dimitzrayim. So he just now gave you what he believes is the second parallel. Taking the money from both, and now the use of the stick or the staff in both. Of course, one is called the makel and one is called a mate. Ukimo shebarach Yaakov, and the same way that Yaakov ran away, came to Mitzrayim. The same way when the Jews left Egypt. Sha'amru, as it says, derech v'chule. So we'll have to figure out what derech v'chule is. I will also point out, okay, should I point it out yet? No. But make sure I point it out afterwards. And if you looked at the previous section, which I didn't feel that we'll do because we don't understand this one, why should we bother looking at the previous one and feeling even more inadequate? In both stories, it says at the end of 3 days, they hear about it. V'chein v'yaged Lavan b'yom hashlishi. Lavan was told on the third day. V'chein hisigu b'yom hashvi'i. In both stories, they catch up to them on the seventh day, derech shivat yamim. And then he writes, Hakol kimo bimitzrayim. Every single aspect is like when the Jews left Egypt, Yaakov leaving Lavan, v'chein kol ha-maaseh l'mishim edakdek. And the entire thing to whoever's being careful. So now what did he just now reveal to you when he said to whoever's being careful? That what he's thinking of is nothing to do with what he's already written. Because he's already written, you don't have to be shemishim and dakdek. He already told you that it has to do with, and by the way, by the time he finished now, I think he's a little bit more convincing than he was when he first started, because he says, oh, well, take a look. You have the 3 days and the 3 days and the 7 days and the 7 days. You have taking the wealth, you have the use of the stick. What I was going to say before is that you also have the Sukkot in both places. They go to Sukkot, Yaakov's Sukkot, and Am Yisrael goes to Sukkot right away. That's the next place which is mentioned. Malach Hashem. And as far as the Vilna Gaon is concerned, like I said, that's what your homework is, to start thinking, what in the world is he talking about when he says that there's more connections, and there are many, many, many connections. But I do want to say one thing. The reason why we don't think about this is because our thinking, for the most part, is result-oriented thinking. And the stories end differently, right? One story ends with all the Egyptians being killed. The other story ends in a very different way. So therefore, because we think of results, results are different. So therefore, why should we bother comparing them to two different stories? So now it's just very strange that Vilna Gaon say, no, this is really the same story, although I can assure you he also knows the way that it ended. So when he's telling us it's the same story, what is he doing? Now, what Tamar said just now was very, very good. You heard what she said? No, say it again. No, how's that connected? In this week, and also in this week's parsha, in B'shalach, right when we're about to have this confrontation, we have Malach Elokim coming. Those of you who will start thinking will hopefully start thinking of more and more and more connections. Let's just take a little bit of a look and then We're going to read something else from the Vilna Gaon, which will be a little bit more understandable, and then we're going to put the two teachings together. Source number three. V'yikashe yoda rachelet Yosef, v'yom Yaakov v'lavan shalacheni v'alecha el makomi u'la'artzi. As soon as Rachel gave birth to Yosef, Yaakov says to Lavan, okay, time for me to go. So, does Yosef have anything to do with the story of Egypt? So, well, yeah, he does have to do something with the story. What? Yeah, he does. Which means Yosef being born, we leave. Yosef is where the whole, well, I won't say the Exodus begins, but it's certainly the Shi'abud begins. We'll come back and see if it's connected to the Exodus as well. Tnei at nashai ve'el yodai asher avadati otcha, bahen ve'el chaki ata yadata et avodati asher avadaticha. You notice the word avdut used time after time in that pasuk over here? So how do you, and I will tell you one other thing I heard about the Vilna Gaon. I heard in his later years in life, the only thing he studied anymore was Chumash. But each pasuk he saw, all of rabbinic literature in that particular pasuk. He didn't have to study anything, which means it's very interesting. When we're very young, where do we start? We start with Chumash, and we get more sophisticated, we go on to more and more sources, but where do you end up at the very end? So he felt at the very end, you just go right back to the Chumash, but obviously you see it a little differently than you saw it the first time around. But knowing what he said, and we look at Yaakov about to start leaving, and we notice the word slavery, enslavement, or you could tell me it just means work. But what do you call work when you don't get paid? Right, that's what made it a little more. What do you call work when you don't get paid? You call it, right? Motherhood, right? So, so that's why that pasuk is a little bit more suspicious. Vayomer elav lovanim namatzati chen beinecha nichashti v'yavarcheni Hashem biglalecha. Lovan says, but I've been blessed because of you. Does that have anything to do with? Well, you can start with Yosef or anything of the Jews in Egypt. It's both in terms of the micro and the macro. From the time that Yosef got there, there was this incredible blessing which emerges. And additionally, the bracha continues, but the bracha continues with the Jews being slaves, which means the Jews being there were very good for their economy. Yaakov being over there by Lavan was very good for Lavan's economy or Lavan's bank account. Tell me your wages, I'll give it to you. Vayoma elav atayadati et asher avadaticha. Again, you know how I've worked or been enslaved, you can decide. When we skip a little bit, pasuk lamed vav, vayesam derech shloshet yamim beino uven Yaakov, v'yakov ro'et son lavan hanotarot. Over here, again, you have the separating of 3 days. By the way, there's 3 days, did that fit into the Pesach story at all? Yes, no, maybe? Yes, okay. V'yikach lo Yaakov makel. Makal. Is it makal? I can't read. Over here is where he takes the stick, in case you didn't remember the stick in the story. The stick is there. Livna lach v'luz v'armon. He takes this, and he uses this, and this is how he then creates his wealth. V'yifrotzi ish ma'od ma'od, and so on. Yaakov gathers his family. Yishlach Yaakov Yikra LeRachel V'Leya. Source 4. Hasadeh El Tzono V'Yom Alehem Ro'o Anochi Et Pnei Avichem Ki Einenu Elai Kitmol Shalshom V'Elokei Avi Haya Imadi V'Teina Yedetchem Ki B'chol Kochi Avadati Et Avichem V'Avichem Eitel Bi V'Echli V'Tzmar Skorati Eseret Monim. He switched my wage 10 times. So this was one of the things the Gaon hinted at, is that the 10 makot connected to the 10 times of the wages were switched, and he saw some kind of a connection there as well. Vayatzel elokim et mikne avichem v'yiten li. And God took his possessions and gave them to me, which is also very similar to God creating the situation that all the Egyptians wanted to give the things over. Source 5, which is really continuation, Pasuk Yudchet. So is the taking of the trafim, is this in any way connected to anything over here? So as I said, this is for you. Yeah? So the binyamin we saw earlier, but what else? I would even suspect taking the rechush, well, Good. What happened to the gold that they took? Right. So it could be that that's something which the Vilna Gaon notices over here. Again, we're reading into it, but that may very well be. Vayivrachu v'chol asher lo v'yakam v'yavor et nahar, which is also something we've never noticed before, that there's a crossing of the sea. Yes? Well, do we admit that we've never noticed that before? That when Yaakov leaves, there's suddenly a crossing of a nahar? What do you call a river? Vayasem et panav har hagil ad. Vayugad l'levan b'yom hashlishi, kivrach Yaakov. V'yikach et achav yimor v'yudof acharav derech shivat yamim v'dbeik oto bahar hagil ad. How similar was that?
Find out by himself, but somebody can tell him like that they
spent the whole. And what does it say over here? It's the exact same phrase, right? Yes? Source number one, Vayugad lemelech Mitzrayim kivarach. And what does it say over here? Vayugad lemelech Mitzrayim kivarach Yaakov. So you have the language here. Yes, we have the language a little bit sharper than we would have, than perhaps we remember or we would have imagined. And as we know, when does Lavan catch up with him? He catches up with him on the seventh day. Still in source number five, Yikach et achav imo v'yadov acharav derech shivat yamim v'dabek oto bahar ha-gilad. And so, and of course, here is where things shifts a little bit. Pasuk of Kaf Dalet is also interesting, and this we never thought about either. Where we have God getting involved in telling Lavan what to do, which again the Gaon would suggest, and yes, I admit I'm putting words in his mouth, would suggest just like God is hardening Paro's heart and directing him one way or the other what to do. God over here is directing Lavan and telling him what he can do and what he can't do. But of course, we know that it's going to be very different. Vayaseg Lavan et Yaakov. I believe that same language is also used. We have that here someplace. Yeah. We cut it out here. Okay. So yes, so correct. So that language is the same as well. And, okay, good. What else? One last thing which we never would have suspected. Love and speech. Which part? Masita v'tiknovet levavi, right? So again, the language has parallels to it. But, you treated my daughters like slaves, you know, like captives, which is also funny. Now, what do you do with that? Well, what do you now realize is being suggested over here that we never thought of before? The shira, and what happens afterwards of the shira? The women get up and with the tof, right? Which means, whose idea was it ultimately to have to sing Az Yashir and to make a big party afterwards when you leave? Ultimately, it was Lavan's idea. Of course, we don't trust Lavan. We don't trust anything he does. We certainly don't trust anything that he says. But it's just very interesting that, again, all of these elements we never paid attention to. And why do we never pay attention to? Because we never had any reason whatsoever to believe that there's anything similar within these two stories. Okay, should I ask you now, did you see enough that you now suspect maybe there's something between them? Yes?
Can I mention another thing? I'm going back, but it starts with Yosef. And Yosef is a Bachor. And so the whole thing with Egypt starts with the Purim.
So.
Purim, and here it starts with the Yadav Chalit Yosef.
Okay.
Yosef is Bachor.
Correct. So let's pause here for a second. There's no question, in my mind, that as far as the Vilna Gaon was concerned, That was the most important point. That Yosef is the most important point. The reason why I say this is because I've read enough of the Vilna Gaon's writings to know to what extent he thought Yosef was significant, or the significance of Yosef, or specifically the significance of Yosef in terms of Egypt, or in terms of this is correct. Yosef is the starting point. Yosef is essential over here as well. You'll also maybe now will have noticed that Yosef may have made one or two cameo appearances in this week's parasha as well. Yes?
What's his name?
A cameo. I don't know how to say that. Yosef does make an appearance or two, maybe even three if you want. Yes, so Yosef somehow is here, but here is where we're going to stop now, and here we're going to go to our second source that I want you to look at. Source number 10, we're going to completely ignore it because you know it. Yes?
Yes.
So, Chad Gadya is something which has suffered a lot because essentially nobody respects it, and it's... Okay. Even people who are not suffering after drinking four cups of wine do not respect Chad Gadya. If you start looking at things said about it, you'll see, oh, it has no depth to it. It's just a story. It's just a story, and there's nothing really to it. And the Vilna Gaon actually thought there was a lot to it. And we're going to read 11. That we don't know. We're going to read...
I wrote a paper.
Yeah? So we're going to read source number 11, which is the Vilna Gaon's commentary to the Chad Gadya. And maybe... Okay, we'll read his commentary. What?
It only appears like in the 16th century.
Right, right. But the question is, you know, what is it saying and what's it communicating? And why do we throw it into the Haggadah? Like, what's it here? So... Let's look at his commentary. Source 11. Chad Gadya, Dizavin Abba. Pirish. Understand. Klal Gadol Etzlainu. Shekol HaTovot. Shehayu. Vishayiyu. Od. Bein Ba'olam Azeh. Ubein Ba'olam Haba. Et Kulum Yerashim Yavotenu Ba'ed Shabirach Yitzchak Et Yaakov. Ululei HaBrachot Chasarnu Et Kol. So, introduction. Everything which is good that we have in this world and the next comes because Yaakov took those brachot. Otherwise, v'kol hayu le'esav. V'hasiba l'habrachot hayu shnei gidei izim. And the reason for all this was because of the two gidei izim. The two gidei izim is, of course, what Yaakov brings in and he makes for his father. So he's telling you that this is what these two gidei izim are. Uvigamara amru v'chi ma'achalu shel Yitzchak hayu shnei gidei izim. And does Yitzchak really need to eat two gidei izim? I mean, what a strange thing. Ella, that Yitzchak was operating in a spiritual world, echad lepesach ve'echad lechagiga. That somehow, in that scene, when Yaakov brings him the two izim, one of them represents the future Korban Pesach, which is an animal that we eat, which facilitates leaving Egypt. That's the Korban Pesach. That's the Pesach. But the other one is the Chagiga, which facilitates the celebration of leaving Egypt. And that's why Yitzchak says, bring two izim. V'rabotenu darshu, I'll comment already. Yaakov takes two things from Esav. He takes the bracha and the bechora, and now you realize we spent a lot of time when we studied Bereshit on those two points. He takes the bracha and takes the bechora. Had Yaakov never taken the bechora, the firstborn, the Jewish people never would have been enslaved in Egypt. That because he took the bechora, what happened? The responsibility of the bechora was to one day be slaves in Egypt. Because he took the bracha, he was able to get out of Egypt. Which means that is one, whether you see this here or not yet, this is what's going on, that the bracha and the bechora, again, all good happens because of these brachot, because then we're able to leave Egypt. Okay, continue. V'rabotenu darshu, kachat shnei gidei izim tovim, tov lecha, tov levenecha, Tov lecha shetirash et ha-brachot. V'tov levanecha sheyizku lavishnei si'irim lechaper aleihem b'yom ha-kippurim. That we just, by the way, all this is coming to explain Chad Gadya, one Gdi, and you notice, of course, the one Gdi just now morphed into four Gdiim, right? You have the Sir La Hashem and Sir La Azazel, you have the Korban Pesach and the Korban Chagiga, and the Vilna Gaon is saying, no, these are not mutually exclusive ideas, these are layers of the same idea. Had it not, I'm going to say it again, had it not been for taking the Bechorah, we never would have gone to Egypt, not taking the Brachot, we never would have gotten out of Egypt. Once we get out of Egypt, we need the Korban Pesach to get out. Then we need to celebrate, which is Korban Chagiga. We also need Yom Kippurim, which is very interesting, because Yom Kippurim, as we have learned together, represents the struggle between Yaakov and Esav when they meet up later on, and it's the bribe that Yaakov gives to Esav in order to get forgiveness for having perhaps taken the Brachot and the Brachorah from him. And therefore, all of these things, as far as the Vilna Gaon is concerned, are not mutually exclusive. The opposite is true. They all go together. Echad laHashem ve'echad laAzazel v'nira dehar b'hatalia. That these are interrelated. What? The Korban Pesach and the Chagiga and the Sir LaHashem and the Sir LaAzazel. K'mo sha'asirim sh'yom ha-kippurim. Echad b'lechaper ve'echad b'lefayes et ha-satan sh'lo yikatreg kach ha-se'irim. And he says a similar relationship with the Korban Pesach, Korban Chagiga. V'yadua, and it's well known, and if it wasn't well known to you, now it will be to you as well. Ki habrachot masar Yaakov avinu olav ha-shalom levno li-yosef, gam ha-bechora natan lo. U'kishi birech Yaakov levanav, bechol ha-shvatim lo nemar lashon bracha. U'v'yosef k'tiv brachot, avicha, tiyena l'rosh Yosef. That Yosef ends up getting from Yaakov both the bracha and the bechora, and again, this is all the spiritual, which means all the spiritual good that we have in the world comes from Yaakov, having taken from Yitzchak, having really taken from Esav. You can decide how that works, and all of this was given over to Yosef. Which why, of course, in the Vilna Gaon's metaphysical world, Yosef is of supreme importance. V'gam ze yadua shehashvatim. Gavra kin'a b'nehem. The brothers, on the other hand, suffered from jealousy of Yosef. By the way, kin'a b'gematria is Yosef. The brothers suffered from kin'a b'nehem. Umachru et Yosef oto l'mitzrayim. Kidei levatel habrachot v'abechora. They try to undo what they anticipated their father would do one day, and they try to break the connection between Yaakov and Yosef. Eila toldat Yaakov Yosef. They try to break it, and that's why they sold Yosef. But now, if you haven't realized yet, what does Yosef then represent as far as they're concerned? The sale of Yosef? Yosef is the Gedi. Chad Gadya, Yosef is the Gedi that was sold. Why was it sold? It was sold because of jealousy. Kedei levatel habrachot v'abachara, v'nitgagel adavar, v'yodu avoteinu limitzrayim. V'ktiv et ha-mateh hazeh tikach biyadecha. And in order to get out, what does God say to Moshe, to Aaron afterwards? Take the mateh. Asher ta'aseh bo et ha-otot. You're going to do the wonders with them. V'chei nivruah shehayu machmat ha-mateh. Everything flows out of the mateh. Now, I'll remind you, he knows what the mateh is, because he's the one who told us before what this mateh is in terms of the Zohar that he was commenting on. You're going to take the mateh. V'chein ananei ha-kavod. V'kol ha-tavod shehayu b'beit ha-mikdash nikra al ha-mateh. The mateh is where all of the spirituality is going to come from, all the way to the building of the Beit HaMikdash. K'mo she'naseh b'yimei Moshe ha-yaschut ha-mateh. All of this comes from the mateh. Moshe masar li Yehoshua, and Moshe ends up giving all this over to Yehoshua. By the way, I'll remind you again where Yeshua comes from. Yosef, from Yosef, via Ephraim. Vizesh Ramaz Bala Agada, and that's what's hinted at in the Chad Gadya. Hech nitgalgel hadavar bevoam lemitzrayim, uve ezes chut nigalu mashahayam e rosh vaatsof, vizesh katov Chad Gadya. All this was his introduction to Chad Gadya, and now we'll fill in a little bit because he actually gave us a little bit more of a hint in the next couple of lines. Yeah. Say it again.
When they took the and they used the blood of the
of the goat, right. So, let's start his commentary now. L'chad Gadya, who was sold, that's Yosef. Yosef was sold. Va'atra, va'ata shunra. Do you see right under it where we're reading? And the cat came. Teva hashunra hi mit kin'at, zeo kin'at hashvatim shekin'u b'Yosef. A cat is a very, any of you like cats, I apologize. But cats are very jealous beings, and therefore, the cat, who is described as the cat in all this, who acts catty, if you will, are the brothers, and therefore the brothers are the ones who sold Yosef. Va'ata kalba, and the dog come, ze paro. Now, paro in various places in rabbinic literature is compared to a dog. What's interesting, I'm going to say it again. Remember at the very beginning I said that there are these various powers that represent both a klipa and the positive. The fact that the dogs don't bark when they're leaving Egypt is the positive side of dogs, as opposed to paro, who acts in terms of the negative side of a dog, and that's how he understands the dog is paro. The atra, ata chutra. What is the chutra? Well, if any of you would have been going through the parasha last couple of weeks with the Targum, you would know that every time it uses the word mateh, the Aramaic for mateh is chutra. So therefore he writes, va'ata chutra zeha mateh, shehikala paro. Which means, paro is compared to the Jews, going backwards, Yosef is the Gedi, the jealousy came from the brothers, they're the ones who sold him down, paro now comes and he beats up the brothers, and we get all the slavery, the stick comes and hits paro. By the way, isn't this much better than you ever imagined that this was going to be? Yes? The stick comes, and that's the mateh, which is where paro gets all of his makot from. Vatanura, what is the nura? He writes, something burns, is a yetzahara. And the yetzahara is what undoes our power, undoes our spiritual power. Remember the Vilna Gaon said that from this mateh is where all kinds of good, again, there were two kinds of good in the beginning. There were the brachot and the mechorah, of course, goes from Yitzchak to Yaakov, and then there is the power of the mateh. But what happens to the mateh? How does the mateh lose its power? Mateh loses power because of the Yetzirah. Yetzirah then can burn the Mateh, as it were, using that visual. But the Mateh, the Vilna Gaon told us, morphs eventually into the Beit HaMikdash. So how does the Beit HaMikdash get destroyed? It gets destroyed because of the Yetzirah. So that's what he's writing over here. Vata Tura. So what is the Tura? Tura is a bull. Ze Edom. Edom now comes. Now, of course, once the Yetzirah comes, that makes the Beit HaMikdash susceptible. That burns our magic, or as it were, the Anane HaKavod, Anane HaKavod become the Beit HaMikdash. That gets rid of the power of it, and now it's susceptible to the Tura. Now, I'm going to warn you about the Tura, because the Tura is very interesting. What is a Tura? What is a Tur? Is a shore. What is a shore? Shore is Yosef. Go back to the point of the Klipa, the holiness versus the unholy, that there is a power. So Edom is the power of the bull. A bull is considered to be a big, powerful, destructive animal. Yosef, a bulldozer, if you will. But it, I mean, it's funny to think of it that way. But that's really what it's saying, is that's this power of Edom. But that's the klipa of the Torah. There's also the power side of it, is Yosef, who's also called a bull, which just now things hopefully got a little bit more interesting. Vishata lemaya. It drank the water, which is again Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish people, or the water, Am Yisrael compared to water, compared to Torah, and so on. And the bull comes and drinks it up, which again, of course, causes destruction and all kinds of pogroms and holocausts and all kinds of terrible things. Ve'ata ha-shochet. And then the shochet comes around. And the shochet over here is the Mashiach ben Yosef. And again, I'm going to tell you that you have the klipa and the powerful part of it. When Yosef comes to Egypt, who does he meet up with? Which house does he end up in? In Potiphar Sar HaTabachim. What is he? He's the Shochet. He's the chief executioner. Which means Yosef and Sar HaTabachim are these parallel powers. And then what happens? Va'ata Malach HaMavet ki Mashiach ben Yosef neherag. And then the Malach HaMavet comes and kills Mashiach ben Yosef. Now, it's very amusing, or not, that the Vilna Gaon stopped right there, because, again, I happen to know a couple of other places that he dealt with this concept. And the question of Mashiach ben Yosef dying or not is Did we speak about that at all? We spoke about this a couple weeks ago. We didn't. I don't remember. The question of Mashiach ben Yosef dying is something which is very interesting. It says in the Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Nun Bet, which is very easy to remember. It's the only place that it talks about Mashiach ben Yosef in the Gemara. It says there that there's going to be this terrible scream and cry and mourning, and there's a machloka what the mourning is for. One opinion is the mourning is because of Mashiach ben Yosef, who's killed. That's Daf Nun Bet, 52 in Gemara Sukkah. The Mashiach ben Yosef has been killed, died, and that's the mourning. But the Gemara actually, if you pay attention, never said he died. It just says there'll be mourning because he died, but never said that he died. Now, how can you possibly have mourning without somebody dying? Well, who was mourned for even though he wasn't dead? Yosef. Which means, there was actually so many times in Yosef's life that he should have been killed, almost so that maybe you think that Yosef should be the cat, that he has nine lives, more so than Am Yisrael being the cat. Which means, when they throw him in the pit, he should have died. When Potiphar's wife accuses him, he should have been killed. I mean, this man's an executioner, he should have been killed. When he gets thrown into prison afterwards, again, he should not have made it out. And Yosef is mourned along the way. His father thinks he's dead the whole time, which means, when the Gemara speaks of the mourning for Mashiach ben Yosef, it doesn't mean because he's dead, but it means there's a perception that he's dead, or there's a vulnerability that he could be killed, but it doesn't actually mean that he's dead. And that's right where the Vilna Gaon leaves us off and doesn't tell us any more about the story. And he says, but that's really the Chad. Again, what comes next? What comes next is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is Malchut, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Melech Machay HaMlachim, right, comes and gets rid of the Malach HaMavid, gets rid of everything, right? Because the Malach HaMavid came and killed the Shochet. The Malach HaMavid comes, and God comes and gets rid. Now, the manifestation of God as Melech Machayim Lachim is through Mashiach ben David, who is Malchut, his kingship on this earth, representing God's kingship. And that's how the story, ends, which of course the whole thing is Mashiach ben Yosef getting ready, Mashiach ben David. But when you read this whole story, you now realize, as far as the Vilna Gaon is concerned, the real tension in this whole thing is really all about, it's all about Yosef. And that's what the whole Chad Gadi is about, because the whole story of Egypt is really the story of Yosef. Now, if we go backwards a little bit, just to fill in a couple of things that maybe we haven't thought of, how do we start the Haggadah? We start with Aramet Avid Avi. What in the world are we talking about Lavan, right? What does Lavan have to do with leaving Egypt? So now how would you all answer that question? Oh, and by the way, now you have a real short Dvar Torah that you can say, right? Aramet Avid Avi, you would think has nothing to do with leaving Egypt, but it probably, and you don't have to say the whole thing, it probably has a lot more to do with leaving Egypt than you ever would have imagined, and you can just look at the parallels, you can look at the using of the staff, and you can look at the 3 days and the 7 days. But there's still something that I want to say about all this, which I think is really what the message is. When we get to our parsha, again this week, the fact that Yosef's remains are a part of this story, the fact that Yeshua is there at the very end to fight against Amalek is also very interesting, because this line where the Gros said that the Torah is Edom and the Shochet comes to kill the shore, the Shochet is Yosef, because Yosef is the one who's able to fight against Edom. Yosef is the one who has the power to fight against Edom. And that is something that, yes, we did discuss that. Yosef is the one who has the power to defeat Edom, and that's really what the Gros is saying over here. Now, how that ends up may actually really depend upon how Klai Yisrael act. Will the jealousy still be there? Which means, is the cycle now going to repeat itself? Is the jealousy still there, where basically Yosef gets sold up the river again? And if that's the case, then even though Yosef is the one who can fight against Edom, but we just now have weakened ourselves because of the hatred and jealousy and sinat chinam and so on, or are we able to be together and to support Yosef? And at that point, then even though there is the susceptibility of Mashiach ben Yosef being killed, but at that point he's not killed. By the way, in proper Sephardic Sidurim, the ones that have Kavanot in it, when you say the words V'chisei David, it says there, have Kavanah that Mashiach ben Yosef not be killed. It says that's the Kavanah that you're supposed to have. It goes back from the Arizal. It's just a daven that Mashiach ben Yosef not be killed, because the Arizal understands exactly what we've said, as the Vilna Gaon writes this in all kinds of places, that just because they mourned for Mashiach ben Yosef never says that he has to be killed going on. And now, this is the important point. And now we'll tie everything together, and we'll end. This is the important point. Just because we had a cycle of, now you can fill in the blanks, violence, abuse, hatred, jealousy, it doesn't mean that that cycle has to repeat itself. That's really what the Chad Gadya is telling us, that this led to this, led to this, led to this, led to this. Now, does this have to go all the way back again? Are we going to sell Yosef up the river again? Are we going to start all over again? Or is this going to have a different ending? So that all depends upon Klal Yisrael being together or not, the Yetzirah being there or not being there, right? The newer the fire, because that's going, meaning there are certain negativities which can come up again and again. Do we have the same cycle or not? Which leads me to the Vilna Gaon's larger point that he doesn't say, and this is how I understand this whole teaching. Going back to the beginning. Of course the whole thing was an absurdity to say that Yaakov leaving Lavan is the exact same thing as Am Yisrael leaving Egypt, because they end so different. And I said this from the very beginning. We are very result-oriented in our thinking, and therefore we can't compare them. So now I want to go back and say what I think the message really is. Leaving Egypt is the prototype for the eventual Geula. Right? And I think there's all kinds of places in Chazal you can find that, B'nisan Nigalu, B'nisan, and so on. It's the prototype. The fact that it's the prototype does not mean that it has to happen the exact same way. So what is the Vilna Gaon really telling us? Yes, leaving Egypt is the prototype for the future Geula, but the future for leaving Egypt, sorry, the prototype for leaving Egypt was Yaakov leaving Lavan. How did that story end? That story ends, yes, they make offerings on a mountain, which, by the way, is the same thing as the offerings on the mountain by Har Sinai, right? Bringing offerings, bringing zvachim, but sitting together and making a covenant, non-belligerence at least, and maybe even a little more than that, which means, how does this story end in terms of the Jewish people and the rest of humanity? Does it end again, and maybe some of you are in favor of this ending, does it end again with all of them, the bottom of the sea, sinking down and drowning, which the Vilna Gaon, and it could be, you can accuse me of being too left-wing on this, but I think the Vilna Gaon, what he's telling us over here, is that that's not necessarily a happy ending. That's not necessarily a happy ending of a whole bunch of people dying in a nuclear holocaust at the very end of history. That's not a happy ending. What's the happy ending? The happy ending is able to, despite the fact that we ran away, despite the fact that we were right in leaving, despite the fact that we took all the possessions, despite the fact that we're going to even things up because of the way they've treated us all these years, but at the end, there you have the sense, you know what, you should have told me, because I really would have wanted to make a party for you, and I wanted to sing for you, and let's sit down and make a covenant that we will have non-belligerence between one another, and we will live and let live. Which is the Vilna Gaon is telling us, is that the end of history has more than one way, which means just because there's a prototype, it doesn't mean that it has to end with that exact way. There's still free will all along the way. And therefore, what's crucial in all this is the ending between Yaakov and Lavan. Let's make a covenant between the two of us, which means in terms of history, God left us over here with, you know, like multiple endings. This is the director's cut. Correct. Paro has the same choices. There are different ways that this story can end. And I think that's what the Vilna Gaon is really telling us over here. That when you look at leaving Egypt by itself, the truth is we have a very negative story at the end of the day. Yes, we won, and yes, we celebrate, and yes, we have to be happy at the end because we made our way out, but there's still something which is missing. We didn't have the impact on them that we could have. And all of the death and destruction. Yes, there's a poetic justice and we feel vindicated, but I think that once the Vilna Gaon is saying, no, there's this story and this story, they're not two different stories. Read them together, weave them together and say, this now is the potential for how we end history. And now you realize there's two different endings over there. The ending of what happens with power, the ending happens with love one, and that's what he's telling you. Again, I'll say it one more time, that the end of history, and that's really what the Chad Gadya leads us to, the end of history has as its source the leaving of Egypt. But the leaving of Egypt has as its source the leaving of Yaakov of Lavan. Yaakov leaving Lavan somehow works out at the end. Despite all of the evidence that wouldn't work out that way, it somehow works out at the end. Leaving Egypt doesn't work out at the end, and they all end up dying. Okay, they die. We're still going to say Hallel, right? I'm not saying anything else. We're still going to say Hallel, and it's okay. We were saved, and we appreciate it. We understand it. And we were maltreated, and we were abused, and we were killed, and we made it. But now the question comes, so how does history end? And that's what the Vilna Gaon is saying. And that's why I put these two teachings together, because when you only saw one, you didn't understand what he was trying to say to us. At the very end, it depends how this is going to work out. In the end, as I said, we're still waiting for that last chapter, but now, at least now we realize there's two possible endings. Yeah. What I said is the Vilna Gaon at an earlier point in his life saw himself as a Gilgul, or as his soul being connected to Mashiach ben Yosef. At a later point in his life, he thought he was connected to Moshe, and that's why he felt he never can go to the land of Israel. But he encouraged all of his students to go. Just like Moshe sends Yehoshua, he then sent all of his students, who included the Rivlin family, which includes the president of Israel today.